You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Shane Claiborne. Shane's the director of Red Letter Christians and the best-selling author of The Irresistible Revolution, Jesus for President, Common Prayer, and Red Letter Revolution. He's a founding member of The Simple Way, a faith community in inner city Philadelphia that has helped birth and connect radical faith communities around the world. The new book is called Executing Grace, How the Death Penalty Killed Jesus and Why It's Killing Us. Shane, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back here with you, man.
I was telling you before we started, you were one of the first guests on the show, and that really meant a lot to me, and I loved our conversation then. It was really special to me, so I'm glad to have you back.
Yeah, man, this is wonderful, and I'm glad to see folks talking about things that really matter, and I'm just delighted to be with you, man.
So, this new book, Executing Grace, it's about the death penalty, mostly in the United States, although you touch on some cases that happen abroad too. One of the things that was most shocking to me that I read in the book was the fact that a lot of times victims or families of victims are often silenced and marginalized if they don't support the death penalty for the killer of their family members.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a certain narrative that shapes and conditions how we've come to think about justice. And so we think about, you know, this is about justice for the victims. And that's why I believe that violence and evil is real in the world. And I think like, how we care for victims is not only an important question, but it's a central, urgently important question. That's why I started the book with them. But what I've come to see is that there are tons and tons of victims of violent crimes and survivors of murders, folks that their closest family members were killed, that are against the death penalty. But that's not always the dominant narrative. There's a reason for that. I mean, we hear it, you know, after the Marathon bombing, some of the most affected people in that were against the death penalty in Boston. Same in Charleston after the terrible church massacre there. But what's also true is that when the victims are for the death penalty, that fits the narrative. So they're often given a microphone, a platform, even incentives for speaking out in favor of the death penalty. But when victims are against the death penalty, for whatever reason, for some of them it's because of their faith, for others it's just because they simply don't want to sign themselves up to 10 years of trials, which it usually amounts to, and, you know, continuing to relive the trauma. But for whatever reason, there's a lot of victims against it, but they are their voice is often squashed. And one of the examples I give of that is Suzanne Bosler, who is a young woman who I've come to just absolutely admire. Her story is horrific. Her dad was killed violently in a stabbing, and she was almost killed in this same crime. She actually was stabbed in the head, only survived by kind of holding her breath and faking her own death, and the man left. Through the course of it, she really became deeply compelled not to seek the death penalty for a lot of different reasons. But one of them is she didn't find it was the best way to honor her dad, who was a pastor and really talked a lot about mercy and grace. But during the course of the trial, that's where things went haywire. She's on the stand, and the judge told her, you cannot speak about sentencing. That's not for you to determine. If you talk about your personal feelings on the death penalty, I'll hold you in contempt of court. He threatened her with a fine and jail time. I mean, you know, and she actually said, I felt like I was the person that was on trial. And that kind of boggles the mind, but I started hearing more and more stories like that. There's a family in Nebraska, the Lamb family, where as their trial went forward, many of the family members were against the death penalty. because of their faith and convictions on capital punishment. But it just didn't fit the story. And so the judge was actually ordered that they were not victims in the traditional sense. So that they were actually kind of silenced in all this. And so those stories like really blew my mind. And there are tremendous groups that have become heroes of mine. Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, Murder Victims Families for Human Rights, groups like Journey of Hope that bring together victims of murder with the family members, the family members of murder victims together with the family members of those who were executed. And together they're saying violence is the problem, not the solution. And it has power because it has all the more credibility. And I've met victims who are for the death penalty. And some of those who have managed to get an execution can still be held hostage to the anger and resentment and fear. And there's other folks, like the countless people I mentioned in the book, who have not found that execution and the death penalty are the best form of justice. And some of them are the brightest lights I've ever met of folks who have survived such horror and yet are some of the most gracious and redemptive people I know. So those have been the heroes of mine as I've written this book.
One of the things I like about the book is that it really comes from all angles. So, you know, you talk about the way the Bible speaks about execution and death, and then the problems with our modern system of execution. I wonder if for a minute, I want to talk about the biblical aspects of execution and theology and all that stuff. But before that, I just want to talk about our process. And if we, you know, if we suspended the other aspects, the ideological concerns, the theological concerns, if we took a not never stance about execution, I think that what we would want is for really the system would have to be flawless, meaning we'd have to be sure that people were guilty. We would have to be sure that the system was fair and equitable, right?
Yeah.
But that's certainly not the case with our system.
Absolutely. And this is why there's a growing movement of conservatives concerned about the death penalty. In states like Nebraska, they have been the people that have led the way to abolish the death penalty. It's very consistent for those who have a distrust of government, you know,
or, right.
You know, don't want to trust the government with health care and things like that. You go, but do we really trust the government with the ultimate irreversible power of life over death? Do we think our government's that trustworthy? I mean, there's all the other sides too. It's, you know, very clear that it costs more to keep the death penalty than to keep someone in life for in prison for life. And so there's the fiscal side. But I think it's very interesting that there are folks that it's the questions of our human imperfection and our government, and our systems are imperfect. And right now that's really clear. I mean, for every 9 people that we've executed, one person has been exonerated from death row. Mm. That means they were sentenced to death wrongfully for crimes that they didn't do. And I mean, that alone, you think like, man, if for every 10 planes that were taken off, if one crashed, we'd be like, all right, we got to ground the planes a little while, you know?
Yeah.
But 156 people that we now know, and those are the only ones that have been able to prove, you know, their innocence in 26 different states, collectively like 1,800 years of life that was taken from them. And so the issue of innocence is a big one. There's a lot of folks that believe in the death penalty in principle, but not in practice, you know. And then there's the racial concerns, racial bias, which is something I talk about in the book, that and that is increasingly clear that the racial biases in the death penalty system are so apparent. As we can see now, one of the biggest determinants for who actually gets executed is race, the race of the victim and the race of the defendant. When the victim is white, and the defendant is black or a person of color, that often ends up being an equation that ends in an execution. Even the zip code that a crime is committed in, we know that like 15 counties are now responsible for the overwhelming majority of death penalty cases. And so you're looking at that and you're going, man, I'm not sure that a zip code should determine whether you live or die. You've got folks like Dwayne Buck, a case down there in Texas where his guilt is not in question. But when it came to his sentencing in Texas, one of the things that's argued is future dangerousness. And in Dwayne Buck's trial, there was evidence that was admitted by the court that said black people are more likely to be violent than white people. I mean, this was actually evidence that was put into his trial and sentencing, and he was convicted to death, and now his case is before the Supreme Court. That you still have folks that have all white juries where people of color have been systemically taken off of the panel of jurors. And so, I mean, this is real. And just to like put that in the historical context a little bit, a lot of folks have said that the death penalty has become the direct descendant of lynching, that where lynchings were happening 100 years ago is precisely where the death penalty continues to survive today. In 1950, black folks were like 22% of our population, but there were 75% of executions. That was in 1950. But now, African Americans are about 12% of the population, but they're still almost half of death row. And African Americans make up a third of all executions. And so as we look at the racial dynamics, it becomes very troubling because you realize that we have this idea that we are killing the worst of the worst, but often we're killing the poorest of the poor, and way out of proportion, we're killing a large number of black and brown brothers and sisters. So there's the racial justice of this, and it's why it's, you know, on the platform for the movement for Black Lives as well. That this is a big part of, I think, the racial healing in our country can begin with things like abolishing the death penalty.
You know, I think we're all kind of aware of things that went down during Jim Crow era and previously that are just, you know, glaring injustices against black folks at the time. I remember reading there was a well-known lynching in Waco, Texas that was just horrific, of a black man convicted of raping a white woman. And, you know, we don't really know if it happened or not, but what we know is that he surely didn't get a fair trial back then. We look at that and it's so glaring. It's so glaringly obvious that was unjust. And then just the other day I heard on the radio the exact story you were telling about a man on death row who, during his trial, there was a expert witness, I guess it was, that said because of his race, he was more likely to
That's Dwayne Buck's case.
Yeah, that was Dwayne Buck. I couldn't remember the name. Yeah,
well, but see, this is not uncommon though. There's you know, half a dozen other cases just like Dwayne's there, and some of those have been overturned. But his case is important because it's before the Supreme Court right now, where they'll be looking at racial bias.
Right, and I think what they and I heard or read that. I think the expert witness, was it a psychologist or something like that?
Yeah, and here's the wild thing, is that it was actually his own defense attorneys that brought this witness.
Oh, gosh.
And it only proves that what Brian, our brother Brian Stevenson, who's an incredible lawyer, and he says, you're often better off being rich and guilty in America than poor and innocent, because you get the justice that you're able to afford. And I mean, there's cases where I know of cases where folks, the defense attorneys have fallen asleep in court. They've showed up drunk to trial. one case of an African-American brother in California, his own defense attorney told him, a black man, that he was that some of the people of color didn't make the best jurists, and so they weren't quite as equipped to be jurors. I mean, this is his own defense attorney. So, I mean, and you have folks that are referred by the N-word still today in court by jurors or their own attorneys or the prosecutors or judges. I mean, racial injustice is still very real.
It's just unspeakable. I mean, it's sounds like things we read about from a bygone era. So the system is not fair. And like you said, even people that don't have a problem with the death penalty on an ideological level see the flaws in it, see that we have killed people who we later found out were innocent. Deeply problematic, even for people that don't have an ideological concern with it. There's good reason to stop it. Let's talk then about the theological side, the biblical side of this. A lot of times we'll hear evangelicals defend the death penalty based on biblical reasons. And in fact, the death penalty is most alive in the Bible Belt, where there are high concentrations of evangelicals.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that as I dug deeper, became one of the deeply troubling parts of all of this, is that the death penalty has survived in America, not in spite of Christians, but because of us. And the truth is, the death penalty wouldn't stand a chance of its continual survival if it weren't for Christians. And I say that as a deeply committed Christian who, for much of my life, I was for the death penalty. I was convinced that it was rooted in Scripture, ordained by God, and I argued in favor of the death penalty. But then as you look closer, you see that these Scriptures that I had misused, I think sometimes I used against the very purposes for which they were intended. For instance, like in the book, I do a lot of work with this, but there's this idea in Scripture of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's actually an ancient framework for thinking of justice that Lex Talionis, it was called, where we get the idea of retaliation. And the idea was that you can do reciprocal harm for the harm that was done to you. But it put a limit on that. So if someone pokes your eye out, an eye for an eye meant you could poke their eye out. But you couldn't poke both their eyes out. You know, if someone broke your arm, you could break their arm back as a form of justice. But you couldn't break, you know, both their arms and their leg and burn down their mom's house. You know, like it put a limit on it. And what is clear as you dig deeper is that this idea that we've often come to use as a license for revenge was just the opposite. It was a limitation of how much you could retaliate. And the intention was actually to stop the perpetuation of violence, not to legitimate it. And revenge is overtly denounced through Scripture. So then it makes a whole lot of sense for me that Jesus comes and says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. Moses told you this, but I tell you this, that there's an even better way. And he's really challenging the fulfillment of this, is that you may have a legal right to return harm for harm, but there's an even better way. And that's why I think Jesus is the culmination of this. But it's also true that, you know, even as we think of an eye for an eye, we would think it's cruel. You know, if someone pokes a person's eye out, that we wouldn't actually like stab their eye out. You know, we don't rape people who rape to show that rape is wrong. But somehow in the most extreme case of murder, we still use the very evil that we hope to get rid of, and we perpetuate that. You know, we stoop to the morality of murder as we try to kill those who kill to show that killing is wrong. And so as I look deeper at Scripture, though, what's also troubling is that there wasn't just one capital crime. You know, it wasn't just for murder, but there are actually 30 crimes that are death worthy according to the Old Testament. And those included things like striking your parents, adultery and sexual fornication, promiscuity, things like sorcery, working on the Sabbath, you know, so there aren't a whole lot of fundamentalists that I think are going, let's bring that back. You know, if right. you work on Sunday, you're gone, man. Like you play with yep. a Ouija board, it's over. So I think like, yet we did that in some of the American colonies, even, you know, in the 1600s, it was still on the books, a capital crime, for striking your parents or, you know, where we get the Salem witch trials, but now we only have it for murder. But I think like what we can look at is that there's this sort of evolution of decency that and also as we begin to think of the fulfillment of this ancient law. But then you look all through scripture and we got a big problem if we think that murderers are beyond redemption, because one of them was none other than Moses, you know, one of the first murderers in the Bible in Exodus. He kills a man and buries him in the sand. David, who committed a terrible affair with Bathsheba, raped her, had her husband killed to cover up what he had done. So David, Moses, Saul of Tarsus, these were murderers. And yet grace gets the last word, you know? So if we believe that a murderer is beyond redemption, we could rip out half the Bible, you know, it'd be a lot shorter without grace. So I think it's so important for those of us who are Christians to ask the question, is anybody beyond redemption? And that's what is also at stake in all of this, is our fundamental belief in redemption and grace and second chances. And there's a lot of stories that I tell in the book, you know, about that. But I think that it's deeply troubling to me that 85% of the executions are happening in the Bible Belt. As my brother says, the Bible Belt has become the death belt. And that's true this year. Almost all of the executions are happening in Texas and Georgia, in two states. And those states are deep, are very concentrated with Christians. So I think we're seeing that change. You know, more and more millennial Christians, like 80% of millennial Christians born after 1980, are against the death penalty. And it's because they can't reconcile it with Jesus and with their faith. But we need courage and we need to challenge Christian leaders, authors, pastors, musicians to really take a stand on this, because it is a very core fundamental spiritual issue. It's a pro-life issue, you know, as we think about what it means to the sanctity of all life, that this isn't abortion's not the only pro-life issue. I think the death penalty and gun violence and these other things are as well. So that's why, you know, I'm thankful for the Pope and Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, so many other leaders that out of their faith, they have come to be compelled to denounce the death penalty, which Martin Luther King said, the death penalty is society's final assertion that it will not forgive. And for those of us that are Christians, we believe in forgiveness and we believe in grace.
Well, I think it was, for me personally, that conviction about abortion is what led to my beliefs on execution. And I, frankly, I don't find that radical in any way, as in the same way that being against abortion, I don't find radical either. It seems just to me being consistent with who Jesus was.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And you see, Jesus, it's Dale Resinella, who's a great scholar on this, he says, any pro-death Christian has the nagging problem of Jesus to deal with. You know, and I would add, we have the nagging problem of the first few centuries of the church that were consistently stood against death and violence in all forms. And they spoke against abortion. They spoke against war and militarism. They spoke passionately against the death penalty. And Jesus in the, you know, iconic interaction with the woman caught in adultery, which was a death penalty case. You know, he interrupts the whole thing and he tells the men, let the one who is without sin cast the first stone. And he really puts the death penalty on trial in that instance and kind of consistently does that. But, you know, I think sometimes we can pit Jesus against the Old Testament, and we don't have to do that either, because we can look at how God deals with Cain. And one of the most, you know, first murders in scripture, Cain killing his brother Abel, and God actually doesn't kill Cain. He marks him and protects him he does punish him and exiles him, but he allows him to live, allows him to have a family and even build a city. So I think that, as we think of what true justice looks like in the heart of God, it's not just about punishing people with what they deserve. It's actually about healing the wounds that sin creates and healing the harm that has been done. And so God's justice is restorative, not just punitive. And I think that's where we get this idea of righteousness and justice. They go together. And they look a lot different from how we've been conditioned to think of justice in our contemporary world.
I'm curious to know what you've found out about those who have done the dirty work of carrying out executions today.
Well, this is the heartbreaking thing that I may even be kind of the shadow of this issue that we don't always notice, the invisible people. And I didn't really think about that too much until I started talking with people who were responsible for that dirty work of executing someone. And I talked with a man named Ron McAndrew, who is a former prison warden, but one of his jobs was supervising executions. He did that in Florida. And they had the electric chair at the time, and one of those executions went haywire, and the man caught on fire. His head began to smoke, and Ron was obviously horrified by that, but he was still for the death penalty. He went on this quest to try to find a better way of executing people. He was trained in lethal injection there in Texas, and then he brought that back to Florida. But he was equally haunted and traumatized as he saw people's life taken from them through the death penalty. And he said, the men that I executed visited me in my sleep, he said. He was haunted by it. And he went on this deep soul journey, and he became convinced that there just is no way, no good way to kill someone, that we are not meant to kill. And when we do kill, it destroys a part of the good in us, you know. And so he's still, you know, I talked to Ron, and he's still like a prison warden. You know, you do the crime, you do the time kind of guy. You can tell he's been spent a lot of time in corrections. But he is passionately against the death penalty, and now is an expert witness about cruel and unusual punishment. So I think there's so many different stories like that. And right now in North Carolina, executions have been halted because the medical community has refused to comply with executions. So the protocol is that you have to have a doctor or nurse present. And the medical community has said, this is a violation of our oath to do no harm. We didn't become lawyers to take life, but to save it, you know. And so they've refused to be a part of executions, and the medical association has backed them. And it's courageous people like that that I think we need all over the place right now to say, we are not going to be a part of the machinery of death. We can do better than this. And I'm so thankful that we have voices of on all sides of this issue that are kind of like monkey wrenches in the gears of death right now.
Well, you know, what you just said brought up a lot of things in my mind. One, you know, speaking of the warden who is, you know, kind of tough on crime, you do the time kind of thing. You know, it reminds me that I don't see any good practical reason for execution. No one that I know of is advocating that these people just walk free. They're not going to be, you know, a threat to society. We can continue to keep them in prisons. So for that reason, it seems completely unnecessary. I think that studies show that the death penalty is in no way a deterrent for crime or murder. The other thing that I thought of when you were talking is all the drama about the method. It seems that we always try to kind of remove people from the actual dirty work from it. You know, they're flipping a switch. They're trying to put some steps in between actually taking a life, but obviously that's what always happens. I think in the last year, there have been one or two botched executions in Texas from lethal injection. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we've had all kinds of terrible botched executions, even recently. It's not like we get better at killing people, you know. It's still horrific. And we've had people, executions take up to 2 hours, you know, as someone fights for their life and as their body's being poisoned or killed. Folks that have beaten their head in the gas chamber so much that they were, you know, had head injuries during the gas chamber. I had recent executions, like one of the ones last year where the poison that they were going to use wasn't even, it was a preservative for food. And Sister Helen Prejean, you know, an incredible icon of the movement, Sister Helen, she said that preservative preserved my brother's life because they ended up stopping the execution. But you think, like, how messed up is this that we have, like, lethal injection drugs that states don't even allow veterinarians to use against animals, and that's what we're putting in people's bodies, and that's why there's the secrecy behind it, because
that's right.
That these pharmaceutical companies, they don't want to be known for creating poison that destroys life. I mean, these are companies that are trying to protect their image and brand as medical and you know, preserving life. And so there's all kinds of stories of what that's looked like. I mean, basically, they have states that are essentially dealing illegal drugs. You know, like Nebraska has gotten drugs from India. From essentially a medical man there, and it was all grandfathered in through a Swiss company that the European Union objected to because they're against the death penalty. And so now they have all these drugs that they bought illegally that they can't even use, you know, and they paid millions of dollars for this stuff. So it's just such a – I think what's amazing, Shane, is that we're using so much energy. We're wasting so many resources trying to keep this – terrible thing alive, and it's keeping us from being able to leverage our imaginations towards better forms of justice, use resources to help victims' families, you know. And there are ways that I think that we can protect society from dangerous people, and that's exactly why the Catholic position has evolved so strongly on this, to where Catholics and the Pope are adamantly against the death penalty, and it's because we have an industrialized society, much better ways to protect society from dangerous people than by killing them, and I think for those of us who are fueled by our faith, we also believe that we leave room for the possibility of redemption. And some denominations, their statement against the death penalty says exactly that. When we end someone's life, we rob them of the possibility of what God's grace might do in them to transform them into a new person.
I just find it so telling that they're in a society who, you know, by and large, we've said this is something we want to permit, yet everybody wants their hands clean from the actual act of it. Like you talked about the drug companies and, you know, again, how we just try to separate ourselves from the actual taking the life part of it. It seems so telling.
Yeah. I mean, we actually try to sanitize it. You know, we make it look like a hospital room. We make it a ritual almost seems like some kind of primitive sacrifice, you know, but it goes all the way back, I think, to Herod washing his hands as he condemned Jesus to die, you know, like, Pilate washing his hands, you know, like no one wants to be a part of this. I think deep down inside of us, something feels conflicted. And that's why we have so many layers of insulation. So you have a jury that convicts someone and sentences them to die. You know, and I had a juror that said, I did not realize when I was doing that the horror that I would live with as I made a decision to end someone's life. You have judges that are a part of that, folks that are parole boards and governors that sign warrants. But there's all these different layers so that we have a system that kills, but no one feels like they are a killer, or no one wants to. And I think we've got to really name the fact that what we are doing is killing people. Literally on the death certificate, it says homicide. Mm. What this is a legal state-sanctioned homicide that those of us who are paying taxes and are complicit on this, like, we continue to allow murder to happen. And I think that this is where being anti-death penalty doesn't mean we're anti-victim. I think we've got to identify with all of the victims of violence. But we can also look at a recent execution there in Texas where I think his name was Adam in March, Adam Ward, that was killed. And as he died, his last words were, he said, "I want to ask forgiveness of everybody that I've hurt, and I want to extend forgiveness for those who are to those who are getting ready to kill me." And I mean, what an amazing thing to think, like, geez, what we are doing is stooping to the very morality that we don't want our kids to embrace, and teaching that killing is wrong by killing is like trying to teach that rape is wrong by raping. And mm-hmm. I think we can do better, and we have to.
Well, one of the things I appreciated so much about the book is that it is full, chocked full of real stories of real victims' families, those who are on death row, the families of those who are on death row. It is so, you put so much flesh and blood to an issue. And one of my favorite stories was about that I knew, you know, kind of the highlights of, but not the details, was the story about the Amish community in Pennsylvania, that after a shooter had come into their one-room schoolhouse and killed a bunch of their children, that Amish community reached out to the perpetrator's family and forgave them and gave them grace and really just became Jesus to them. That, to me, is so much, such a better story than killing those to show that killing is wrong.
Yeah, and that story has the capacity to heal the world. You know, the whole world was watching as the Amish community responded. And I've gotten to know Terry Roberts over the years. She's one of the folks that I write about in the book. And she was the mother of Charlie Roberts, who was responsible for the shooting. And then he took his own life. And the Amish families just embraced the family of the Roberts family. And Terry talks about the power of seeing this Amish father holding her own husband as they wept together over the death of their kids. And the Amish families, you know, they went to the funeral of Charlie Roberts to be with him. They created a scholarship fund for the kids of, these are the kids of the man who was responsible for taking the lives of their own. And that grace, it just fascinated the world. And now it's interesting because the story continues to unfold. And one of the things that Terry Roberts has found healing from this, is she regularly goes and visits Rosanna, one of the little girls who survived the shooting. But her life is very different now, and her physical body is limited. And Terry goes and visits her, and they spend time together, and they sing, and they laugh, and they read stories. And over the years, that's been a part of her healing. And she's confronted every time she looks into the eyes of Rosanna, she knows the horror that her son was responsible for. But grace gets the last word, you know, and that the end of the story of the Amish school shooting is not just a bunch of girls who died and a madman, a gunman who took his own life. Like, the end of the story is actually grace, and it's healing, and it's a hope that we can end the trauma of violence everywhere. So it's one of those beautiful stories, and I think we need more of those.
Shane, thanks for telling all these stories and really bringing a message to us that we really need. I really, really hope that we see the end of the death penalty. Shane, thanks for being on the show and talking with me.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me. We'll do it again sometime.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,